My name is Henry Cowart. I'm the official photographer for the Jerash International Project. I have a Bachelor of Science in Photography degree from Rochester Institute of Technology in the United States. And my previous experience in the archaeological photography world has been at the early bronze sites of Babadra and Numera in the southern Dead Sea Valley. Thank you very much for your interest in listening to this tape. I'll start right in with the relationship to the photographer, of the photographer, to the archaeologist as I have seen it. One, it must be remembered that the photographer is not an archaeologist. Very often, he is not even a photographer, but a volunteer that has been handed the position. In this business, as in any other business, you get what you pay for. So if you give a volunteer a camera and tell him you're the photographer, then you can expect photographs that can be exactly described the same way as photographs that a volunteer took, perhaps quite acceptable for his mother or aunt when he gets home, but certainly not, well, possibly not, for the serious archaeologist, for serious scientific study. The photographer is in a rather unique position on the project in that if he has two camera bodies, three lenses, and a handful of accessories, then it's very possible that he has exceeded 300 moving parts, all of which are sensitive to heat, light, sand, dust, all the constant companions of an archaeological project in Jordan in the summertime when most of them are held. The square supervisor with four Gufa carriers has, if he is lucky, four moving parts, usually two, sometimes three, but hardly ever four Gufas move at once. It's therefore easy to forget that the photographer has this problem with his technical equipment. This should be kept in mind. The photographer is responsible for the technical quality of the photographs, that is, the proper exposure and the care of the exposed film. In many projects, unfortunately, one person takes the photographs back in the United States or in Europe at the home university, another person develops them, and yet a third person possibly prints them. Thus, after this chain of one person to another, when the photographs come back gray and uninteresting, or gray and blurry, the first instinct of the field director is to say, gee, this photographer took terrible pictures. The only way to ensure quality all the way through is to keep it in the family, so to speak. The photographer is responsible for keeping adequate records so that the director of the project, when he returns to the United States or wherever, can identify the photograph on the roll by the photographer's records. The photographer, for every picture, should record the roll number, the frame number, the field number, the square number in the field, the locus or loci number, should there be more than one, the direction in which the photograph is taken, and the date. He should also include, and this he obtains from the field supervisor, a short description of the photograph, enough to identify it. Now, this is not the long drawn out description that the archaeologist will record in his field notebook. Just enough to identify the picture is all. The archaeologist in the field should include in his notebook all of this above information, plus a detailed justification and explanation of why he thought this photograph was pertinent. The photographer should include what is known as a slate shot on the first one or two rolls first one or two frames, excuse me, of the film. So if all his records are lost, the roll of film can be identified as roll 28 or roll 29 or whatever. And therefore, it is possible for the director, though through arduous searching, to go back and search through the field archaeologist's notes and identify every photograph. So the slate shot is quite important. The photographer is not responsible for deciding what is or is not worthy of a photograph. Since he's not an archaeologist, he cannot be expected to be able to evaluate whether a possible mud brick detritus surface is worthy of a recording photograph. He should not be fought over, so to speak. In some cases, in the early morning light in Jordan, in the summertime especially, two or more, possibly, field supervisors may need a color photograph of something the first thing in the morning, and since you only have about 15 minutes of good light before the sun comes up, somebody has to make the decision about what takes precedence over something else. This is a touchy political decision on an archaeological project. It's not the photographer's job to do this. It's the director and the field archaeologist's job to get together and decide what takes precedence over what. If you leave it up to the photographer, you will wind up with pictures of lizards and wildflowers. A few words about scales. Every scientific photograph should include some sort of scale to give a relative idea of the size of the object included in the photograph. The standard scale for archaeological work is the 1 meter wooden rule, usually divided into 10 centimeter segments, 10 black and white centimeter segments. It should be square, so it will sit up at any angle. It helps to have a small nail driven through one end to stand it up vertically against balks and balk sections because it tends to blow over in the wind. It should be made out of the hardest wood possible so it does not dent up and break the edges off during hard use. In Jordan, it's hard to find wood hard enough for that. In addition to the 1 meter, a half meter stick is useful for situations like door sockets or mortars in situ, where the 15 centimeter scale that's normally used for smaller details is too small and the 1 meter scale is too big. For small details, a 15 centimeter black and white or red and white wooden scale is very useful. For the studio, 10 or 5 centimeter stiff paper black and white usually black and white scales are very good. For large photographs or wide angle photographs of a completed excavation or an excavated area, the 2 meter orange and white or red and white range rod is very useful. The orange and white does not show very well on black and white film, so many photographers immediately repaint these black and white. For small objects used on the fluorescent light or the incandescent light box, small object method described in the handout, a small plastic, clear plastic ruler is very handy. If you get a new one and take care of it, the scratches won't show. It should have no hole in it, at least at the lower end. It should have no brand name written on it. Should be as clear as possible. It should be free of scratches. If you follow the procedure in the handout, with a clear plastic scale with black numbers on it, it will appear as though there has been a scale laid down by the printer. It will look very nice. It is not so important for the scale to extend past the edge, that the scale not extend past the edge of the photograph as it is in close-up, as it is, excuse me, in field photography. The 1 meter stick, or indeed any length in the field, should not extend outside the frame of the picture. They should, whenever possible, be parallel to the side of the photograph. You should be very careful, particularly in the studio, not to use a metal ruler. Now, metal rulers are very, there's a temptation to use them because they're very resistant to scratches. And they look very nice when you hold them in your hand, but it's almost impossible to light one evenly across it enough that one end or the other of the ruler doesn't flare out, that is, shine too much, reflect too much light in the picture. So don't use a metal ruler. For aerial photographs, a 4-meter arrow, wooden arrow, divided into black and white meter lengths is very useful, usually pointing north. A few words on aerial photography while we're on that subject. The Jordanian Air Force has been very helpful in the past for providing small aircraft, helicopters and airplanes, to assist archaeologists in survey and recording work on their expeditions. A helicopter is, of course, preferred, but if you can only get an airplane, that will be just fine. Very often, in fact, always in my experience, the Air Force requires that they be notified some weeks in advance. And in many cases, particularly in the sensitive central Jordan area, they will want to take the exposed film, process it, censor it, and return it to you. At Babadra, we had no trouble whatsoever with this. We asked the Air Force to provide us with a helicopter, and they were most helpful in sending us a nice French helicopter that we used to take several nice pictures at Babadra. In the Bekaa Valley in 1981, Dr. Patrick McGovern used a helicopter from the Jordanian Air Force, but they took and censored his film and returned it to him, though there were no important archaeological points deleted. They've been most helpful. In any photography from an aircraft, you want to be careful and not brace the camera against the window. You may not feel the extreme vibration in any sort of propeller-driven aircraft, be it helicopter or fixed wing, but it's there. It'll blur the picture. You should use as fast a shutter speed as possible, no more than a 500th, nor less than a 125th, if possible. Try to avoid the shadow of the photo of the aircraft on the ground. Try to avoid including any parts of the aircraft in the photograph, that is the wheel or the wing or anything. This is distracting. If you don't have an airplane, then there are several alternatives, some more desirable than others. At the Jerash project, we have a Yalbert parafoil kite. It takes four people to hold the thing down with an automatic camera mount and motor drive from it. The advantages are the thing is commercially available as a package. The disadvantage is it takes a wind and four people to hold it down. We also have a hydrogen balloon with a motor mount, a motor drive camera mount. Unfortunately, we haven't got any hydrogen yet, and this has not been tried out. But there are several books, one particularly photography from kites and balloons in the Acor Library. That should be available to anyone who's interested in the subject. A perhaps more practical solution is a wooden or metal bipod, which we used one of these at Babadra and found it to be extremely useful, particularly for excavated ruins at Numera. It took 12 people to run our bipod at Babadra and Numera, mainly because it was made from the wood obtained commercially here in Jordan, which, since it is imported, is not of the best type. You can't find hickory or oak here, so you must do with soft pine. And it took 12 people to hold the thing and stabilize it because it was so flimsy and heavy. I have investigated prices here and discovered that for no more than twice the cost of a wooden bipod, an aluminum bipod can be constructed that should prove very useful and yet not warp around so badly. In the summertime in Jordan, when most archaeological projects are afield, you have a very bright, sunny situation, much too bright and sunny for good scientific recording, for optimum scientific recording. The sun, say on one side to another of a large rock in Jordan in the summertime at 10 o'clock in the morning, will vary about 5 f-stops, which is about 1,200%, depending on how you figure it. Now, a color slide film can only handle about a 1 f-stop range. So thus, color transparency photographs taken in Jordan at 10 o'clock in the morning are virtually worthless. So you have to think of some way to beat this extreme contrast problem. One way is to get up and take your color photographs in the morning light. The disadvantage of this, it's a beautiful light, but the disadvantage is, one, it only lasts for about 30 minutes if you're real lucky. So that means for another 7.5 hours of an 8-hour working day, the photographer must grapple with this same problem. Also, occasionally, for long exposures in the very early morning light, the film will have a tendency to have a color shift to it that is somewhat undesirable. A way of getting around this later in the day that has proved very successful at several excavations is the use of a 4x4 meter white linen or cotton sheet. Usually you have to buy 4 1-meter-wide, 4-meter-long lengths and have somebody sew them together, but any tailor should be able to whip you out one in a day. The sheet must be white or it will give an undesirable color cast to the photograph. At Babadra the first year, we had one that had a green cast to it that was not really noticeable to the eye, but in color transparency, it was very noticeable immediately. A few words about light in general, particularly flashlight. I have a slide here for illustration of a EB-1B tomb at Babadra that is illuminated both by direct flash and by bounced flash off the ceiling of the tomb. The bounced flash shows considerable discoloration because when you flash a light against any surface, the light bouncing off that surface assumes the color balance of that surface. So this causes some little trouble in and of itself. But it gives a nice soft light. There are no harsh shadows in detail. The photograph is rich in detail. If perchance the director returns home and finds that there is not a color photograph, a color slide, of a particular feature that he would like to discuss in a lecture or use for training purposes in his classroom, but he finds that there is a black and white negative picture of it, it's very easy to load your camera with black and white color negative film and screw a slide copier onto the end of a macro or close-up lens. You have to have some sort of close-up attachment for this. If you put the negative in the slide copier and take a picture of a negative, you wind up with a black and white slide. They look very nice and are very useful for instruction purposes. A few words about plans and drawings for display purposes. If you have a black on white map and photograph it on high contrast litho film, that is very high contrast printer's film, then you get a very nice, very durable white on black display slide. The advantages of this are, one, you don't have to keep it clean, because since it's all white on black, most of it's black, and if it gets a little dust on it, you're not going to notice it over the teeny tiny white parts. Two, it's much easier on the eyes of the audience when it gets flashed on the screen. I have here a companion slide with it in black on white, made on high contrast film to resemble a line drawing on white paper, which is miserably dirty after just a few showings, for an example. A few words on equipment. For the well-equipped photographer to go to the field on any major project at all, he should have two camera bodies, and should they be battery-driven models, batteries there for them. At least three lenses, a 28mm or wider wide-angle, a 50mm normal lens, and a 100 to 135mm longer lens. Up to 200 millimeters. Beyond 200 millimeters is just a little much for an archaeological project. He should have a good tripod. Don't be cheap on the tripod. Few things in life are as frustrating as a flimsy, cheap tripod. He should have a close-up attachment of some sort, a bellows, a macro lens, that is a lens that focuses very close, or a close-up filter that screws on the front of the lens. Close-up filters can offer a considerable quality at a very low expenditure. They have several advantages, and a good set will take as good a picture as the original lens will at a normal working distance. So they should not be, you should not look down your nose at close-up filters that screw on the front of the lens. You see a lot of amateurs with them, but they do a very good job. You should have a handheld light meter. If you only have camera light meters and you're an absolute expert at using them, no problem. But if you're not, and I'm certainly not, get a light meter. You should have plenty of cable releases. You can't punch the button on a camera at a 1 second exposure, which is a common exposure in the early morning light on an archaeological project, and not shake the camera. You should have as big an electronic flash as you can possibly afford or carry. Among professional photographers, that is the criterion for an electronic flash. You should have as big a one as you can possibly carry. A lump of modeling clay is useful for setting small objects up and scales upright, as is a copy stand, especially useful for small object photography. That's described in some detail in the handout. A few words on films. One of the most commonly asked questions is about films. Starting with black and white films, they fall into roughly three categories. The very slow 32 to 50 ASA, very fine grain black and white. Common brands are Ilford Pan-F and Kodak Panatomic X. Their advantages are they're very fine grain. Extreme enlargements are possible from this film. Its disadvantages are they are very slow and very contrasty and quite difficult to work with in the laboratory. In the Middle East, they have become the standards of archaeological recording because, one, they have very fine grain, and amateurs tend to place, which most field directors fall into the category of amateur photographers. That's the first thing you learn not to like in a photograph as an amateur is grain. And the other reason that they are the favorite is because that's what everybody got in the habit of using. They're gradually being superseded by the 125 ASA class, which the advantages of this are good workable speed and fine grain, not extremely fine grain, but fine enough for all practical purposes. Common brands are Ilford FP4 and Kodak Plus X. These are very forgiving under less than ideal conditions, and that's a key phrase for the archaeological project. They allow ample enlargement for reproduction purposes. Panatomic X can offer excellent results. The small grain 32 to 50 ASA films. can give you excellent results, view camera almost quality, large format quality, under optimum conditions, but they are very unforgiving for the slightest mistake during processing or handling. The third class is the 400 ASA class. The advantages of these are their fast shutter speeds and extreme depth of field. They are very forgiving of exposure and processing errors. They are low contrast films, particularly useful in the bright daylight, but then again, they have such a fast speed that that's a problem in bright daylight, so that pretty well balances itself off. Their main disadvantage is that they are quite grainy. Ilford HP5 and Kodak Tri-X are popular brands. They are the choice of most professional photographers for artistic and photojournalistic work. Almost every newspaper photograph you ever saw was done on Tri-X. They are not considered suitable for most archaeological applications, but they can be very useful under low light conditions, like in tombs where you need your electronic flash to reach as far as it can. If you didn't have anything except Tri-X, you could record your excavation quite satisfactorily, perhaps. A few words about color films. The Kodachrome family is the most common color transparency film used in the Middle East. Kodachrome 25, that is 25 ASA, has the sharpest, finest grain of any 35 millimeter film. It is, being only 25 ASA, very slow and quite contrasty. It's very unforgiving of extreme differences between the highlight and shadow side of a rock, for instance. That you're in at Baba Draw in the summertime, it's quite possible that we would have either solid white or solid black in the photograph, and no detail whatsoever. Kodachrome 64 is almost as sharp as Kodachrome 25. It's very difficult for anybody to tell the difference by looking at the slide on the screen. It has very fine grain, finer than anything else except its brother Kodachrome. It's 130% faster than Kodachrome 25 and a considerably better choice for general use. Kodachrome can be purchased in Jordan in 36 exposure rolls with processing included. I don't know how much it costs. It's quite reasonable, actually, when you consider what you're getting. No local processing facilities exist. The Kodachromes together are the most permanent of all color materials. They're estimated to last up to 60 years by Kodak estimates under optimum conditions. More importantly, they are very tolerant of heat and abuse, and heat and delay between exposure and processing. Agfachrome 64, particularly Agfachrome 64 professional film, has a good reputation the world over. They have a reputation for outstanding quality, but it is my understanding that they have now been added to the Arab economic boycott for some reason or another. Anyone interested, I have to admit, I have very little experience with Agfa products. I've only used their black and white paper. They make by far the best black and white paper. But if you're interested in these products, you should consult the Agfa shop in downtown Amman across from the main post office. Next is a family of films known as the E6 films. This comes from the Kodak Ektachrome number 6 process design, of which they are all either copies of or originals of. This includes Ektachrome 64 ASA, 200 ASA, and 400 ASA, Sakurachrome 100 and 400, Fujichrome 100 and 400. I just saw in a magazine the other day, Ilfachrome 400 and 100. There may be others. They are all exactly the same, basically the same. There may be some slight differences, but it is too slight to really be important. The faster the film, the larger the grain under any circumstances, no matter what you have, black and white, color slide, color negative, anything, the faster film, the higher the grain, the bigger the grain. The ektachromes have the advantage of a lower contrast than Kodachrome, and they can be processed locally. I just had some done in Amman not long ago. They may be off a little bit in color. They are not as true to color as the Kodachromes are. They have a considerable sensitivity to heat and delay after exposure. So you have to be careful. You got to keep cool, and you got to get them processed right after you photograph them, within reason. And they have mediocre permanence, only up to about 20 years. I think Kodak's estimate is about 8 to 12 years, but I have seen estimates for some up to 20 years. The 400 ASA films can be lifesavers in low light conditions. There is a photograph in the main room at ACOR of an EB1A tomb at Babadra taken on ASA 400 color slide film and then made to a print. Looks just fine. There may be some others that I haven't mentioned. The photographic world changes almost from day to day. It's hard to keep track of it on the whole. There are, in particular, some black, some off-brandy sort of black and white films that are just as good as the name brand products and can be used with confidence. Thank you very much for your interest. I'm sorry you missed the lecture, but I hope you've learned a little something from my tape. Good evening.